Have you ever had one of those nights where you are just so completely like bone deep exhausted that your limbs actually ache?
Oh, yeah, like a physical heaviness.
Exactly. Like your body is made of lead, but then the second your head hits the pillow, your brain decides to, run a marathon.
It's the worst feeling in the world.
It really is. You're just staring at the ceiling at like 3 in the morning. Your heart is thumping against your ribs for absolutely no reason.
Right, and your mind is just racing through, I mean, a million different anxieties.
Yeah, you are desperately tired, and yet you feel completely wired. Or maybe you've had the experience of trying to push through a wave of midday fatigue.
Like when you just chug that third cup of coffee.
Right, you force yourself to finish the presentation, or you go to the gym anyway, and then 2 days later, you feel like you've been hit by a truck.
And you just can't figure out why your body is punishing you.
Exactly. So if any of this sounds even remotely familiar to you, you really need to hear what we are unpacking today, because it is going to completely upend how you think about your energy, your burnout, and, well, your fundamental understanding of health.
Yeah, we managed to get our hands on this really profound academic white paper. It was published in 2026 by Dr. Bichara Soli.
And the title is Mitochondrial Life Capacity, right?
Yes. And the mission of this deep dive today is to really extract the most fascinating perspective-shifting insights from what is honestly a very dense biological framework.
It is incredibly dense. I mean, reading it took me a minute.
Oh, for sure. But we are going to look at how the microscopic powerhouses inside your cells are. Like, not just blind engines. They are actually reading your life.
Wait, reading your life? Like, literally.
Literally, they are constantly interpreting your social safety, your work stress, your physical environment, and they are adjusting your energy levels accordingly.
That is just, I really want to spend some time setting up this paradigm shift right off the bat. Because going through this research, I realized that my entire concept of what it means to be healthy has been essentially backward my whole life.
I think most of us are in that boat, honestly.
Right. Because most of us operate under this old idea of disease management. We think of health as just the absence of a diagnosable disease.
Yeah, you go to the doctor, they run some labs.
And if the numbers on the paper are in the normal range, you are officially fine.
Even if you feel terrible.
Exactly. But this paper moves us into a world of what it calls life capacity. So the goal today is to help you, listening right now, understand the incredibly ancient, brilliant intelligence behind your body's exhaustion.
Because that limitation of our current medical system, it's becoming impossible to ignore. I mean, if you look at modern medicine, it is nothing short of miraculous when it comes to acute care.
Oh, absolutely. If I'm in a car accident, I want modern medicine.
Right. Or if you have appendicitis or a severe bacterial infection, you absolutely want to be in a modern hospital.
Yeah.
But we are facing a massive global crisis when it comes to chronic
Like
conditions.
unprecedented levels, right?
Unprecedented. We are seeing epidemic levels of chronic fatigue, burnout, long COVID, dysautonomia, and just a whole spectrum of medically unexplained symptoms.
And these are situations where patients are suffering profoundly, but, their standard blood panels come back perfect.
Which is incredibly invalidating.
It really is. You sit in that sterile
Yeah.
exam room, the doctor gives you a clean bill of health, and you walk out to your car thinking, "Am I losing my mind?"
Because I barely had the energy to drive here.
Well, I shouldn't say exactly, because the paper argues that you aren't losing your mind. Your body is actually functioning with a brutal protective logic.
Yeah, and this brings us to Dr. Safely's concept of life coherent health. The paper argues we need to redefine health entirely.
So, moving away from just the lack of pathology.
Right. It shouldn't be defined by a lack of pathology. It should be defined as being life capacity enabled.
Okay, life capacity enabled. What does that actually look like in practice?
It means having the biological energy, the literal cellular currency, to repair your tissues, to relate to other human beings, to learn new things, and to participate meaningfully in your environment.
I love that. Participating meaningfully.
Yeah. And to grasp how we achieve that, we have to understand what the paper calls coherent energy transformation.
Okay, coherent energy transformation. Let's break that down into plain English because, I mean, it sounds a bit like quantum physics jargon.
It does sound intimidating, I know, but at its core, it's basically an economic system.
An economic system inside the body.
Yeah. Every second of your life, your body is making difficult economic choices about where to spend its budget.
Okay, that makes sense.
Coherent energy transformation is your body's ability to take the resources you give it, like the food you eat, the oxygen you breathe, and turn them into biological work.
So that could be like digesting lunch or fighting a virus.
Or solving a math problem. Exactly. But here is the crucial part. It has to do that while preserving the internal conditions necessary for future repair.
Oh, wow. So it's not just about spending the energy.
Right. It's about spending it in a way that doesn't bankrupt the system for tomorrow.
Okay, so we're talking about sustainability at a totally microscopic level. I was actually trying to come up with a way to visualize this while reading through the notes.
Let's hear it.
So think of the old medical model, like a car mechanic who only ever opens the hood after the engine has completely seized up, right? You're stranded on the highway.
Yeah, they deal with the catastrophe.
Exactly. But this life capacity framework is more like a high-performance racing engineer. They aren't waiting for the engine to blow.
They're being proactive.
Right. They are analyzing the octane of the fuel. They are looking at the baseline efficiency of the pistons. And most importantly, they are looking at the track conditions.
Ah, the track conditions. That's a great point.
Because, you know, it doesn't matter how good the engine is if the driver is constantly redlining the RPMs in first gear while driving up a rocky, muddy mountain road.
I'd actually build on that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the track conditions in your racing scenario represent a major concept in this paper. It's called organism niche coupling.
Organism niche coupling. Okay, define niche in this context.
In biology, your niche is your environment. But it's not just the temperature or the altitude like we usually think.
What else is it?
It is your sense of social safety. It is the air quality in your neighborhood. It is the power dynamics at your office. It's your financial security.
Wait, really? The power dynamics at my office are part of my biological niche?
Absolutely. The paper argues that the organism and the niche are deeply coupled. Your environment literally dictates how your biology allocates its energy.
That is wild, because we tend to casually brush off things like stress or overwork as just lifestyle factors.
Right, as if they were just vague psychological concepts.
Yeah, like, oh, I'm just stressed.
But they aren't vague at all. They are rigid, energetic instruction sets being delivered directly to your cells.
Okay, I really need to pause on that because that is a massive conceptual leap.
It is a big leap, yeah.
You are saying that my cells, like the microscopic blobs of biology inside my tissues, are literally adapting their physical energy output based on whether I feel emotionally stressed about a deadline at work.
That is exactly what I'm saying.
But how does a cell even know I have a deadline? It doesn't have a calendar.
It knows because your brain translates that psychological deadline into a chemical and electrical threat.
Okay, so the brain is the translator.
Right. And if your body detects a threat, it doesn't matter if it's a physical predator chasing you or a toxic boss yelling at you. It makes an immediate economic choice.
And what's the choice?
It diverts the energy budget toward immune defense, hypervigilance, and stress hormone pathways.
Wow. So it defunds other things to pay for that.
Exactly. To pay for that defense, it pulls energy away from higher cognition, away from deep digestion, and crucially, away from cellular repair.
Which explains why your stomach gets messed up when you're stressed.
Totally. Health fails when these fourth economic choices become chronic. Mm-hmm. You can't keep redlining the engine on that dirt road indefinitely.
Yeah, eventually, the fundamental machinery of energy production begins to warp.
Yeah, and which brings us to the engine itself.
Right, because if we want to understand this energy economy, we really have to look under the hood at the mitochondria.
We do. And they are endlessly fascinating.
In reading this paper, I realized that everything I learned in high school biology about mitochondria is essentially a cartoon.
Oh, the classic high school biology curriculum.
Yeah. We all had to memorize the phrase, the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Everybody knows that one sentence.
Right. And the picture in the textbook always looked like a little bean. Or like a static little Duracell battery just sitting there waiting to be used.
We really need to retire that battery metaphor. It's actually doing us a disservice.
Why is that?
Because it gives people the false impression that energy is just something you store up and then deplete, like your smartphone battery.
Oh, I see. So you plug it in, charge it, and drain it. That's not how it works.
Not at all. The paper goes into incredible detail showing that mitochondria are highly dynamic, constant flow systems.
Well, systems, okay.
Yeah, to understand the pathology of exhaustion, we have to understand the architecture of this flow. And this flow takes place in something called the electron transport chain, or the ETC.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics of the ETC. Because when you actually visualize what is happening inside your cells right now, it is mind-blowing.
It really is quantum biology at work.
So walk me through it. I eat a sandwich. What happens?
So when you eat a meal, Your digestive system breaks that food down. The actual energy from that food is eventually carried by specific molecules.
Do they have names?
Yeah, mainly NADH and FADH2. And they carry the energy in the form of high-energy electrons.
Okay, so think of these molecules as little delivery trucks carrying volatile cargo.
That's a perfect way to picture it. These trucks drive up to the inner membrane of the mitochondrion.
And then what? They just dump the cargo.
Sort of. They drop off these electrons into a series of stations, which we call respiratory complexes.
So the electrons are being handed off from one complex to the next, like a microscopic bucket brigade.
Yes. And as the electrons jump down this chain, they release a tiny bit of energy at each step.
Okay, and what does the cell do with that tiny bit of energy?
The mitochondrion uses that energy to physically pump protons across the membrane. This creates a massive electrical and chemical gradient.
So you are basically building up a dam of protons on one side of the membrane.
Exactly like a dam. And then at the very end of the chain, all those protons rush back through a remarkable molecular machine called ATP synthase.
ATP synthase.
Right. And it acts exactly like a turbine in a hydroelectric dam. The rush of protons physically spins the rotor of this enzyme.
Wait, it physically spins, like an actual mechanical rotor?
Yes. At thousands of revolutions per minute.
Yeah.
And that mechanical spinning forces molecules together to create ATP.
Which is the universal energy currency of your life.
Exactly.
That is just incredible. So the flow of electrons creates the pressure spins the turbine, and the turbine churns out the energy that allows me to blink or think or run.
You got it. So it relies entirely on the smoothness of that flow.
And the flow relies entirely on the physical structure housing it, right?
Yes. And the paper places a huge emphasis on the architecture of what are called the cristae.
The cristae. C-R-I-S-T-A-E.
Right. If you look at a high-resolution electron microscope image of a mitochondrion, the inner membrane isn't just a smooth circle.
It's not just a hollow bean.
No. It is folded into these intricate, tightly packed, wavy mazes. These folds are the cristae.
They look almost like a fingerprint, right?
Yeah.
Or the folds of a brain.
Yeah, very similar visually.
Why are they shaped like that? Is it just to fit more turbines inside the space?
It's partly about surface area, yes. More folds mean more space for those electron transport chains.
Okay, makes sense.
But it's also about creating incredibly tight microcompartments where that proton gradient can be concentrated. The physical structure literally dictates your energetic possibility.
So the shape is the function.
Exactly. If you have beautifully organized, tight crista, you have a strong, stable proton gradient, and you produce abundant ATP.
And what if you don't?
If those folds become flattened, fragmented, or sparse, which is exactly what happens during chronic stress or illness, your energetic capacity physically plummets.
Wow. It's like the walls of the hydroelectric dam are just crumbling.
That's a great way to put it. The dam crumbles, the pressure drops, the turbine stops spinning.
And what's wild is that this architecture isn't even permanent. The paper talks about mitochondrial dynamics, and I mean, it reads like a science fiction concept to me.
It really does.
Yeah.
Because these things are constantly shape-shifting, fusing together, breaking apart.
So it's a continuous rhythmic cycle.
Yeah, a cycle of quality, control, and adaptation. There are four main processes. First is fusion.
Fusion, like coming together.
Right. This is when individual mitochondria literally dock with each other and merge their membranes to form massive interconnected networks.
Why would they do that?
They do this to share resources, mix their DNA, and sort of dilute any localized damage. It's a pooling of resources.
Okay. So it's like a corporate merger during a tough financial quarter to keep the company afloat?
That's a really good way to look at it. But then you have the opposite process, which is fission.
Fission. Breaking apart.
Exactly. When a part of the mitochondrial network becomes too damaged to function, the network physically severs it. It pinches off the bad segment, isolating it from the healthy network.
Okay, so if fusion is the corporate merger, fission is firing the underperforming department so they don't drag the whole stock price down.
Precisely. Well, it actually goes further than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because after fission isolates the damaged part, the third process kicks in, which is mitophagy.
Mitophagy.
Right. This is where the cell deploys a biological garbage disposal, an autophagosome, to come in, swallow the damaged mitochondrion, and break it down into raw materials.
Okay, so they recycle the bad department.
Yeah. And finally, the fourth process is biogenesis, which is the construction of fresh, new mitochondrial capacity from those recycled parts.
Wow. So your baseline health depends on the rhythmic, uninterrupted coordination of all four of these processes.
Exactly. Fusion, fission, mitophagy, and biogenesis.
Okay, here is where the paper introduces a concept that completely, and I mean completely, contradicted everything I thought I knew about cellular health.
I have a feeling I know which part you're talking about.
I bet you do. For decades, the wellness industry has hammered into our heads that oxidative stress and free radicals are the ultimate villains of aging and disease.
Oh, absolutely. The great enemy.
Right. We are told to take high-dose antioxidants, drink green tea, eat handfuls of blueberries, just fight the oxidation at all costs.
Yeah, it's a huge industry.
But Dr. Saley's paper introduces this other term, reductive stress, and argues that having too much fuel in the system is just as dangerous.
It is a massive paradigm shift.
I actually have to push back here for a second because I've been told my whole life that free radicals are the enemy. Are you saying that having a surplus of fuel creates this reductive stress, and that's equally bad?
Yes, and this is perhaps the most crucial realization in the entire paper. The medical community is moving away from the idea that free radicals are just rogue villains we need to suppress.
So they aren't the bad guys.
Not inherently. Reductive stress and oxidative stress aren't opposites. They are actually two manifestations of the exact same underlying problem, a disturbed flow of electrons.
Okay, walk me through that. How does too much fuel become toxic?
Let's go back to our highway analogy for the electron transport chain. Reductive stress is essentially upstream congestion.
Upstream congestion, like a traffic jam.
Exactly. Imagine you are eating constantly, you are stressed, you aren't moving much, you are sending thousands of those delivery trucks, the NADH molecules carrying electrons, to the start of the highway.
Okay, so lots of trucks getting on the on-ramp.
Right. But the downstream demand for energy isn't there. Or maybe the turbines are damaged. So the electrons can't move forward. The highway backs up.
You get a massive pileup at the on-ramp.
Yes, this creates a high ratio of NADH to NAD plus THO. The system becomes highly reduced, meaning crammed with electrons that have nowhere to go.
So the cars are just idling on the on-ramp, bumper to bumper. Where does the oxidative stress come in then?
Oxidative stress is the downstream consequence of that pileup. Because the complexes are congested, electrons start physically leaking out of the sides of the transport chain.
Oh, wow. They literally leak out.
Yeah. And when these stray electrons hit the oxygen floating nearby, they create highly reactive free radicals or reactive oxygen species.
Wait, so oxidative damage is just the leakage caused by reductive congestion.
Exactly. The traffic jam causes the crashes.
That makes so much sense. And it explains why just blindly taking massive doses of antioxidants doesn't always work and sometimes actually makes things worse.
Right, because you aren't fixing the root cause.
If you have a traffic jam on the highway and cars are crashing through the guardrails, throwing an antioxidant at it is like, it's like sending a street sweeper to clean up the debris on the side of the road.
That's exactly what it's like.
It doesn't actually clear the traffic jam. It doesn't fix the flow.
And in some cases, you are actually sweeping up signaling molecules that the cell needs to know it's in danger.
Wait, the free radicals are signals.
Yes, in small amounts, they tell the cell to adapt. So you have to match the input of fuel to the actual demand for ATP
Yeah.
and the availability of oxygen. You have to clear the lanes.
Okay, so what happens when this flow gets bottlenecked, but our daily life just refuses to let up?
That's where things get dangerous.
Right, because you have a microscopic traffic jam in your cells, but your alarm goes off, your kids need to be fed, your boss is demanding a project update.
And you are probably trying to squeeze in a high-intensity workout because you think it will give you energy.
Yes, exactly. So what happens then?
When you demand high-level output from a congested system, you create the core pathology of modern exhaustion. The paper calls it the energy gap.
The energy gap.
Yes, and the paper makes a brilliant distinction here that we really need to understand. There is a massive difference between an energy deficit and an energy gap.
Right, because an energy deficit is a pretty straightforward supply problem. You
Yeah.
are fasting or you are starving. You physically haven't consumed enough calories, so there is no fuel.
Exactly, that's a deficit. But an energy gap is far more insidious.
How so?
An energy gap happens when you have an abundance of fuel, plenty of glucose, plenty of fatty acids, and you are breathing plenty of oxygen. But you have insufficient transformation capacity.
Ah, so the fuel is there, but it can't be used.
Right, because of reductive stress, damaged cristae, or stalled dynamics, the mitochondria simply cannot process the fuel into usable ATP fast enough to meet the demand you're placing on them.
So it's like a city going dark during a blizzard.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
The power lines are frozen and snapped. It doesn't matter if there are 10,000 tons of coal sitting at the power plant.
Right, the fuel is useless.
Exactly. The infrastructure to transform that potential energy into electricity in people's homes is broken. You have an energy gap.
That's a perfect illustration. And your cells, being survival engines, they don't just throw their hands up and die when this gap occurs.
They fight back.
They deploy emergency workarounds. The first step is local compensation.
Local compensation? What does that look like?
When the mitochondria are bottlenecked, the cell shifts its metabolism to take the pressure off. It starts relying heavily on a process called glycolysis.
Glycolysis. I remember that from high school chemistry. That's breaking down sugar outside the mitochondria, right?
Yes. Normally, a cell wants to process glucose all the way through the mitochondria because it's incredibly efficient. You get around 36 ATP per molecule of glucose.
Wow, 36. That's a good return on investment.
But when the mitochondria are jammed, the cell just breaks the glucose in half in the main fluid of the cell. You only get a tiny, rapid burst of just 2 ATP, and it produces lactate as a byproduct.
Just 2 ATP? That's terrible.
It is. The paper refers to this as a Warburg-like metabolic shift.
Warburg, as in Otto Warburg, the scientist who studied cancer cells.
Yes, exactly. Otto Warburg discovered in the 1920s that cancer cells rely almost entirely on this inefficient glycolysis, even when there is plenty of oxygen available.
Why would they do that if it's so inefficient?
It's a survival mechanism for cells under extreme redox pressure. By bypassing the mitochondria, the cell gets a tiny bit of immediate energy and relieves some of the reductive stress traffic jam.
But if you're only getting 2 ATP instead of 36, you have to burn through massive amounts of glucose just to tread water.
Massive amounts. You're constantly starving for sugar.
And you are flooding the tissue with lactate. I know from lifting weights that lactate makes your muscles burn, so this can't be a good long-term strategy for everyday living.
It is a disastrous long-term strategy. It's highly inefficient, it depletes your glucose reserves rapidly, and it creates a highly acidic, inflammatory local environment in the tissues.
So you literally feel stiff, heavy, and achy.
Yes. And if the energetic strain continues, this local compensation fails. The cell realizes it cannot fix the problem on its own.
So it panics.
Well, it escalates the situation to global management. This is the transition to global compensation.
It calls for backup.
It sends out an SOS.
Yeah.
Struggling cells start manufacturing and releasing specific distress hormones into the bloodstream.
What kind of hormones?
The paper identifies two primary molecular messengers for this, GDF15 and FGF21.
GDF15. As I was reading the source material, this little molecule kept popping up. It really feels like the smoking gun for so many chronic fatigue conditions.
It is a massive piece of the puzzle. These aren't just generic inflammation markers. They are highly specific mitochondrial distress signals.
And where did they go?
They circulate through your blood, cross the blood-brain barrier, and hit very specific receptors in the brainstem, specifically an area called the area poststrema and the hypothalamus.
Okay.
The paper defines this communication pathway as mitoception and metaboception.
Mitoception. So just like I have proprioception, the ability to know where my arm is in space without looking at it, my brain has mitoception.
Yes, precise.
It can actually feel the state of my microscopic mitochondrial network.
It can. Your brain is a prediction engine. It is constantly listening to the cellular voices coming up through the blood and the vagus nerve.
And what does it do with those voices?
It uses those signals to build a central body budget. It has to know how much energy it has in the bank before it allows you to spend it.
I love this concept because it completely reframes how we experience fatigue on a psychological level.
It changes everything.
Let's expand on the corporate analogy we started earlier. Imagine your body is a massive manufacturing conglomerate.
Okay, I'm with you.
The mitochondria are the blue-collar workers on the factory floor running the assembly lines. When the machines start overheating, the turbine breaks down and the assembly line gets jammed. That's the energy gap.
Right.
The factory floor managers realize they are heading for a catastrophic failure, so they draft an emergency memo.
And that memo is the molecule GDF15.
Exactly. They send it straight up the corporate ladder to the CEO's office, which is the hypothalamus in your brain. They say, "Sir, we are at absolute maximum capacity. We cannot process any more orders. The system is melting down."
And if the CEO is competent, what is their immediate response to that memo?
Well, the CEO doesn't tell the workers to just push through it. The CEO immediately shuts down all non-essential departments to save the core business.
Oh, gosh.
They freeze new hiring. They cancel the R&D expansion. They defund the marketing department. They even cancel the company holiday party.
Yeah, everything non-essential stops.
Yeah.
And in human biological terms, the CEO, your brain, generates the overwhelming sensation of fatigue.
It creates the feeling of exhaustion.
Right. It suppresses your appetite so you don't bring in more fuel to a jammed system.
Yeah, yeah.
It kills your libido. It causes profound social withdrawal.
That translates the biology perfectly. And this is why we have to completely, radically reframe our cultural understanding of fatigue.
We really do.
Fatigue is not a weakness. It is not a lack of willpower. It is not laziness. And it is certainly not a psychological failing.
No. It is a highly intelligent, biologically necessary command wrapped in a feeling.
A command wrapped in a feeling. Wow.
The paper provides a brilliant definition. It defines fatigue as the brain's felt narrowing of energetic affordance.
The felt narrowing of energetic affordance. I need to chew on that for a second. Meaning the world literally feels less available to you.
Yes. The physical environment seems to shrink.
A flight of stairs looks impossibly steep. Calling a friend on the phone feels like preparing to climb a mountain.
Because your brain is actively manipulating your perception to stop you from acting.
So it's tricking me into resting.
It is calculated, based on the GDF-15 levels, that further exertion is biologically unsafe. It is protecting your vital organs from catastrophic metabolic failure by making you feel too heavy, too lethargic, and too unmotivated to push yourself over the edge.
So think about what this means for how we treat people who are chronically exhausted.
It's pretty tragic, honestly.
Right, because the standard societal advice, and frankly a lot of medical advice, is always push through it, mind over matter, get out of bed and exercise, you'll feel better.
Just do it.
Yes, just do it.
Under this framework, that advice is actively dangerous. You do not try to push through a protective alarm.
It's like a smoke detector.
Exactly. If your house's carbon monoxide detector goes off, you don't put in earplugs. Tell yourself you just need to be mentally tougher and go back to sleep.
No, you have to figure out what the alarm is trying to warn you about.
Right. If you push through fatigue that is driven by high GDF-15 and an energy gap, you are forcing an already bottlenecked, reductively stressed system to take on even more electron traffic.
Which just causes more leakage.
You will cause more oxidative leakage, more structural fragmentation of those beautiful Christies, and you will deepen the energy gap.
But I want to circle back to the listener's experience that we brought up at the very beginning of the deep dive, because there is a glaring paradox here.
The tired but wired paradox.
Yes. If fatigue is a deliberate command from the brain's CEO to power down, conserve energy, and stop moving, why do so many exhausted people feel incredibly anxious, jittery, and entirely unable to rest?
That's a great question.
If the body wants to sleep, why the hell does it keep me awake with my heart pounding?
To unravel that paradox, we have to look at the effective energy map that Dr. Savely outlines in the paper.
Okay, what is that?
It's a conceptual grid that crosses two variables. On the vertical axis, you have your capacity for energy, meaning high capacity versus low capacity.
Okay.
And on the horizontal axis, you have your level of arousal or neurological activation, high arousal versus low arousal.
Okay, I'm picturing the grid. So top right quadrant. Mm-hmm. If you have high capacity, healthy mitochondria, clear flow, and high arousal, you feel vital.
Right. You are ready to go. You're energized, focused. Maybe you're playing a sport or giving a presentation.
Got it. And bottom left quadrant, you have low capacity and low arousal. That's standard fatigue.
You have the flu, or you just ran a marathon and you just want to sink into the mattress and disappear.
Right. Those states make logical sense. They match. But then there is the danger zone, the bottom right quadrant.
Yes. Low capacity combined with high arousal.
This is the clinical definition of the tired but wired state.
Exactly. Your body is caught in a horrific biological contradiction. It is simultaneously trying to mobilize and conserve.
Mobilizing and conserving at the exact same time. That sounds like stepping on the gas pedal and the emergency brake simultaneously.
That's exactly what it is.
How does that even happen?
It happens because two different ancient survival circuits are firing at once.
Okay, break them down.
On the mobilization side, your brain perceives a threat. Maybe it's chronic pain, maybe it's a traumatic memory, maybe it's severe financial anxiety.
Okay, so it sees a tiger, basically.
Right. So it activates your sympathetic nervous system and your HPA axis.
Mm.
It floods your bloodstream with cortisol and adrenaline.
It dumps stored glucose into your blood to feed your muscles.
It makes your heart race, your pupils dilate, and your vigilance skyrocket. Your brain is shouting, fight or run.
But on the conservation side?
On the conservation side, your mitochondria are choking. They're looking at this massive demand for energy, looking at their fragmented cristae, and screaming, we don't have the transformation capacity for this.
So they hit the emergency stop button?
They start pumping out GDF-15. That molecule hits the brainstem and causes profound, crushing fatigue, nausea, loss of motivation, and a complete inability to engage in complex thought.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate for the listener right now.
Go for it.
Because if I am lying in bed in this tired but wired state, my heart is hammering, I'm sweating, my mind is racing with catastrophic thoughts, but I literally don't have the physical energy to walk to the kitchen to get a glass of water, how in the world does evolutionary biology think this state is helpful?
It's hard to see the logic.
It feels like a total glitch in the matrix.
It feels like a glitch in our modern context, yes. But it has a very grim evolutionary logic.
Grim? How so?
I want you to imagine you are an ancestral human. You have been starving for weeks, or you are recovering from a severe infection. Your baseline capacity is incredibly low.
Okay, I'm exhausted and starving.
Suddenly, a predator, a saber-toothed tiger, enters your camp. You must marshal every last microscopic drop of ATP in your body to run up a tree or fight for your life. That is the high arousal, the adrenaline, the cortisol.
But I'm still starving and sick.
Exactly. So the brain uses the fatigue signaling to make absolutely sure you don't waste a single molecule of ATP on anything other than surviving the tiger.
Oh, wow.
It makes digestion feel impossible so you don't eat. It suppresses your immune system because fighting a cold doesn't matter if you get eaten in the next 5 minutes.
It makes socializing or resting feel agonizing.
Your body locks you into a highly restricted state where the only affordance available to you is sheer blind panic and survival.
Wow. It makes everything else feel impossible so that survival is the only option left on the menu.
Yes. And the tragedy of modern chronic illnesses like long COVID, myalgic encephalomyelitis, severe dysautonomia, or trauma-related burnout is that they represent what the paper calls locked compensation.
Locked compensation, meaning they can't turn it off.
The body gets stuck in this loop of mobilizing for a threat, but it never actually resolves the threat and transitions into the repair phase.
The physical predator is gone, or maybe the predator is just an overflowing email inbox or a latent virus.
But the physiology is locked in the tiger response.
But the system is just perpetually redlining in neutral, burning through its parts. That is both exhausting and terrifying.
It is deeply destructive over time.
So the million-dollar question is, how do we break out of this locked state? Because clearly, forcing our way out or trying to biohack our way out with stimulants doesn't work.
It just adds more traffic to the highway.
The paper brings up a concept here that bridges ancient philosophy and modern biology, and it's called the art of not forcing.
This is one of the most beautiful sections of the paper, in my opinion. It introduces the concept of Wu-Wei physiology.
Wu-Wei, W-U-W-E-I.
Yes. Wu-Wei is an ancient Taoist concept that roughly translates to minimal forcing, effortless action, or acting in alignment with the natural flow of things.
Okay, so how does that apply to biology?
Dr. Saley applies this to biology to explain that health is not a state of constant activation or constant optimization. True health is coherent alternation.
Coherent alternation, meaning the ability to smoothly swing back and forth between different states.
Exactly.
Give me some concrete examples of these biological seesaws.
Well, your entire cellular biology is built on opposing pathways. We talked about mitochondrial dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
You have fission separating the bad parts, which must alternate with fusion integrating the healthy network.
Right, the corporate merger and firing.
In your metabolism, you have a pathway called AMPK, which is a catabolic pathway focused on breaking things down, cleaning up debris, and sensing energy deficits. That must alternate with MPOR, which is the anabolic pathway for growth, building muscle, and cell proliferation.
So AMPK is cleanup, MTOR is growth.
Right. And in your nervous system, you have the sympathetic branch for mobilization, which must alternate with the parasympathetic branch for rest and digestion.
So you can't be all growth all the time. You can't be all MTOR, building, building, building.
You cannot. If a cell is stuck in MTOR, it's essentially cancer, unregulated growth.
Oh, wow.
And this introduces a concept that I think will resonate deeply with anyone who feels guilty about resting. Hidden healing labor.
Hidden healing labor.
We have been culturally conditioned to think of resting as a passive state. We think resting is just the absence of work.
Right, like being lazy.
But biologically, resting is an incredibly active, energy-intensive process.
I really want to dive into this because this completely shifts the guilt associated with exhaustion. Let's talk about the cellular construction site.
So when an exhausted, burned-out person is lying on the couch, staring at the wall from the outside, society judges them as inactive.
You're just doing nothing.
Right. But inside, if the body feels safe enough to enter parasympathetic mode, they're running a massive internal construction site.
What are they building?
They're undergoing autophagy, which is the process where cells hunt down and digest their own damaged organelles and misfolded
A
proteins.
biological garbage disposal.
They are managing proteostasis, meticulously folding new proteins into the correct 3D shapes. They are resolving immune inflammation, sweeping up the battlefield after a viral fight.
All of that takes energy.
All of this hidden healing labor requires massive amounts of ATP.
Think about it like a busy restaurant closing down for the night. Just because the closed sign is flipped on the front door, the lights are dimmed, and the external demands are gone, that does not mean nothing is happening inside.
Not at all.
The staff doesn't just freeze in place. The late-night crew comes in. They are scrubbing the grease off the floors. They are taking inventory. They are restocking the walk-in fridge.
They are fixing the broken burner on the stove.
They are reconciling the cash register. It's hard work. If the restaurant manager demands that the place stays open 24/7 to maximize profits and never lets the night crew do their job, what happens?
The place falls apart.
Eventually, the kitchen completely breaks down, the hygiene fails, the food goes rotten, the ovens catch fire, and the restaurant collapses.
That analogy perfectly maps onto our societal expectations. What's fascinating and disturbing is that modern society is structurally designed to demand constant MTOR activation.
Constant growth.
Constant growth, constant building, constant productivity, constant hustle, and it demands constant sympathetic activation.
We are always on.
We are always responding to notifications, always consuming information, always worrying about the economy.
This cultural operating system completely overrides the biological necessity of AMPK cleanup and parasympathetic repair. We never let the restaurant close.
We don't, and the consequences are everywhere.
Okay, so we recognize the problem. We know we are locked in the tired but wired state, and we know we need the restaurant to close so the night crew can do the hidden healing labor.
Right. How do we actually achieve this? The paper outlines two distinct architectures required for this healing to take place, one inside the body and one outside the body in our environment.
Let's start with the internal mechanism.
Okay.
The inner architecture of healing is called salugenesis. The root salus means health. Salugenesis is the active, structured completion of the healing process.
Okay, completion of the process.
And what's vital to understand is that healing isn't just a switch you flip from sick to well. It is a highly ordered, sequential cycle that costs a lot of energy.
Walk us through the specific phases of that cycle, because seeing healing broken down into chronological steps made me realize why chronic illness is so hard to shake.
The cycle has five distinct phases. First is the cell danger response.
The CDR.
The cell detects a threat. Maybe it's a COVID virus. Maybe it's a chemical toxin. Maybe it's severe physical trauma. The mitochondria instantly change their shape, stop making ATP for normal life, and dump their resources into cellular defense. That's phase one.
They drop their tools and pick up shields. Exactly. Phase two is inflammation.
Which everyone hates.
Right. But the body uses massive amounts of energy to flood the area with immune cells, clear out the invading pathogen or the dead tissue, and create a localized quarantine zone.
It feels terrible. You get feverish, swollen, and exhausted, but it's necessary.
Phase three is proliferation. Once the danger is cleared, the cells start rapidly dividing to build new tissue, new blood vessels, and a new extracellular matrix to replace what was lost.
So containment, then cleanup, then rebuilding.
Right. Then comes phase four, remodeling. That new tissue is often chaotic and disorganized, like a messy scar. The body has to spend energy refining it, organizing the collagen, and making it functional.
And phase five.
Phase five is reintegration. The repaired tissue reestablishes communication with the rest of the body, the mitochondria return to their normal network dynamics, and the tissue goes back to participating in normal life. The salogenic cycle is complete.
So what happens in chronic illness? Where does the cycle break down?
Chronic illness, in this framework, is fundamentally a stalled salogenic cycle. The body gets stuck.
Stuck where?
Most often, it gets stuck in the cell danger response or the inflammation phase. The mitochondria perceive that the threat is still present, so the defense mechanisms never turn off.
The body never moves forward into remodeling and reintegration.
It's like a country that declares martial law to fight a war, but then never repeals it.
Oh, wow.
All the country's resources go to the military indefinitely, and eventually the roads, the schools, and the hospitals crumble.
That is such a vivid way to understand autoimmune diseases or chronic fatigue. The military budget has consumed the entire economy.
Exactly.
So that is cellogenesis, the biological process.
Yeah.
But the paper makes a profound argument that this inner process relies entirely on the outer architecture.
Yep.
It calls this salutogenesis.
Yes, salutogenesis refers to the creation of health through your environment. Dr. Selle calls this the affordance field.
The affordance field.
It is the external mitochondrial infrastructure of your life. And it includes the things we all know we need: restorative sleep, nourishing, unprocessed food, safe and appropriate movement, clean air, clean water.
The basics.
But profoundly, and this is where the paper breaks new ground, it also includes psychosocial factors. Deep social connection, agency, and human dignity.
Okay, I have to stop you here because I really struggled with this part of the paper. I need to push back.
I figured you might.
It's easy for me to understand how a physical virus or a toxic chemical damages a physical cell, but this is where the paper starts sounding a bit philosophical.
It's soft.
Yeah, it feels like we are blurring the lines between sociology and biology. Are you genuinely telling me that having a sense of meaning in my life, or feeling respected by my boss, or not facing societal discrimination literally changes how my mitochondria fold proteins? It sounds a bit woo-woo.
I completely understand the skepticism, because we have been trained to separate the mind and the body. But I assure you, it is not woo-woo. It is hard, measurable biophysics.
Okay, prove it to me.
Let's look at the energetic cost of psychosocial threat. Think about experiences like public humiliation, profound isolation, systemic poverty, or being trapped in a job where you have zero agency.
Awful things to experience.
Yes, but they are not just fleeting, abstract emotional states. To your brain, they are existential threats.
Because the brain, evolutionarily, knows that if you are cast out of the tribe, you die.
Precisely. If you are humiliated or ostracized, the ancient parts of your brain calculate that you are going to lose access to the campfire, to shared food, to protection.
It calculates a severe survival threat.
And so it signals the mitochondria to lock into the cell danger response. And maintaining that state of hypervigilance, pumping out cortisol, keeping the immune system on a hair trigger, that requires a continuous, heavy expenditure of ATP.
So being poor or being lonely or feeling worthless is literally physically exhausting at a cellular level. It is a drain on the battery.
It is a massive energetic tax. Your mitochondria are diverting energy away from cellogenesis, away from the hidden healing labor, the cellular cleanup, the immune resolution, and sinking it all into defense.
And the reverse is true.
Conversely, feelings of belonging, safety, agency, and dignity literally lower the energetic cost of existing.
Oh.
When you feel deeply safe with a loved one, your brain sends a signal down the vagus nerve to the mitochondria that says, the environment is secure. We can put the shields down.
And suddenly all that trapped energy is freed up and redirected toward the night crew to clean the restaurant.
Exactly. Which introduces the critical concept of restorative margins.
Restorative margins.
This is the crux of biological resilience. Your resilience depends entirely on having a buffer, a restorative margin.
Like having savings in the bank.
Right. If your social safety is low, if you are working three jobs to make rent, if you live in a noisy, polluted neighborhood, your baseline energetic expenditure is incredibly high.
Because you're constantly defending.
Your restorative margin is paper thin. You have no buffer.
So if you have a paper thin margin and then a tiny extra stressor comes along,
it causes a catastrophic crash. You catch a mild cold, or you have one night of bad sleep, and because your limited energy budget is already entirely consumed by baseline vigilance, you don't have the ATP to mount an immune response.
Your system collapses into the energy gap.
But someone with a wide restorative margin,
mm-hmm.
someone who is well-rested, financially secure, socially supported, can catch that exact same cold and verily notice it.
Because their cells have the excess capacity to fund the cellogenic healing cycle without bankrupting the system.
Exactly.
Okay, so if our environment, our society, and our relationships literally dictate our cellular health and our capacity to heal, how do we measure this?
That is the big question.
Because standard medicine doesn't have a blood test for lack of dignity or paper-thin restorative margin. And more importantly, how does this shift change how we design our lives and our society?
That is the ultimate macro-level conclusion of Dr. Siley's paper. It scales all the way up to civilizational design.
Civilizational design.
The paper argues that modern hyper-capitalist civilization is deeply organized around extraction, attention capture, and relentless productivity.
Which we all feel.
This creates an incredible, unprecedented civilizational burden on what the paper calls our cellular life ground.
We are literally extracting the biological energy from our own cells, from our own citizens' mitochondria, to fuel the GDP.
We are. And the way our medical system measures health right now completely fails to capture the damage this is doing.
Back to the blood tests.
Right. In the clinic, as we discussed, we rely on static biomarkers. You go to the lab, you sit calmly in a chair at rest, they draw your blood, and they measure your fasting glucose, your white blood cell count, your cholesterol.
And if the numbers look okay while you are sitting still doing nothing, they say you are healthy.
But that doesn't tell you anything about what happens when that person actually leaves the clinic and tries to live their life.
It's like testing a car's engine while it's in park, idling in the garage and saying, looks great, without ever seeing what happens when it tries to go 70 miles an hour on the highway.
Exactly. The paper strongly advocates for a shift toward dynamic testing.
Dynamic testing, what does that mean?
We shouldn't just measure the organism at rest. We need to measure the organism's capacity to transform energy under load. And more importantly, how efficiently it recovers after the demand.
This perfectly segues into a huge topic that is deeply misunderstood. Post-exertional malaise, or PE.
Yes, PE.
I want to unpack PM because this is the defining, debilitating symptom for millions of people with ME/CFS and long COVID. It's the phenomenon where pushing yourself causes a delayed crash. How does this framework explain PE biologically?
PE is the ultimate manifestation of an energy gap colliding with forced exertion. It is what happens when you push an organism to expend energy when it has absolutely zero restorative margin and severe mitochondrial bottlenecks.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's say a patient with long COVID decides to go for a brisk 30-minute jog because their doctor told them exercise is the best medicine.
Right, they want to get better, so they force it.
In the moment, they might be able to summon enough sympathetic nervous system adrenaline to actually complete the jog.
They push through.
But because their mitochondria have damaged cristae and are locked in reductive stress, they cannot organically produce enough ATP to fund that run.
So what do?
They're relying entirely on that inefficient lactate-producing warbird shift. The transformation capacity is bottlenecked, so they incur massive, localized cellular debt.
They redline the broken engine?
Yes, and the consequences aren't always immediate. It takes 24 to 48 hours for the massive wave of oxidative damage, the accumulation of cellular debris, and the spike in GDF-15 to fully hit the brain.
And then the crash comes.
The result is a delayed, devastating physiological crash that can last for days, weeks, or even months. The patient is bedbound in pain with severe cognitive fog.
This is why prescribing graded exercise therapy to a patient who has no restorative margin is not just unhelpful, it is actively physically harmful.
It causes structural damage to the mitochondrial network and locks them even deeper into the cell danger response.
So our measurements, our fitness trackers, our medical tests, they shouldn't be about grading the body like a strict, unforgiving teacher.
No, not at all.
It shouldn't be your smartwatch buzzing and saying, you only walked 2,000 steps today, you failed, get up. It should be about listening to the body like a translator.
I love that framing. We have to be incredibly careful of what the paper calls metric capture.
Metric cap.
It's a sociological concept where the measurement itself becomes the goal, replacing the actual intended goal.
Oh, I fall victim to this all the time. When closing the colorful activity rings on your smartwatch becomes more important than actually feeling rested.
Yes, exactly.
You force yourself to do jumping jacks at 11:00 p.m. just to appease the algorithm, even though your body is screaming for sleep.
Yes, that is metric capture. We gamify health, and we turn our bodies into optimization projects. Mm-hmm. We obsess over our sleep score numbers, our HRV data, our step counts, our blood test ranges.
But the actual goal of health isn't a perfect metric.
The goal is lived healing. The goal is expanding your capacity to joyfully participate in the life you want to live.
It is so incredibly liberating to realize that health isn't about hitting a productivity metric. You are not a machine meant to be perfectly optimized for labor.
Which brings us to the final necessary macro-level shift in public health. If we accept Dr. Saisley's framework, we have to move away from the toxic culture of blaming individuals for their exhaustion.
The individual blame game.
We can't just keep looking at burned out, chronically ill populations and telling them, you need to practice better self-care, you need to eat more kale, you need to do more yoga, you need to sleep 8 hours, you need to meditate.
It's the ultimate gaslighting. You can't tell a single mother to eat organic whole foods and meditate for an hour a day if she lives in an urban food desert, works three minimum wage jobs just to survive, and has no childcare.
You literally can't.
The environment she lives in makes those lifestyle choices energetically impossible to achieve.
Exactly. Expecting individuals to meditate their way out of a toxic, extractive environment is biological nonsense.
So what's the solution?
The shift must be toward affordance design. Public health shouldn't just be about lecturing people. It should be about creating the macro structures that make salogenesis possible.
Like what?
We need to design cities, structure work weeks, build care systems, and reform food systems so that restorative sleep, safe movement, deep social connection, and clean nutrition are the baseline default.
They should be the floor, not the ceiling.
They should be accessible and energetically affordable for everyone by simply existing in the society, not just a luxury reserved for the privileged few who can afford to buy their way out of the civilizational burden.
Okay, we have covered an absolutely staggering amount of ground today. We have zoomed all the way in to look at the microscopic, wavy folds of the mitochondrial cristae, and we've zoomed all the way out to look at the macroscopic design of our hyper-extractive civilization.
It is a breathtaking, unifying framework.
It really is.
If there's one thing to take away, it's that we have learned fatigue is not a failure. It is not laziness.
Yeah.
It is a highly intelligent, protective signal from your brain warning you of a critical energy gap.
We've explored how the maddening, tired but wired state is actually a locked evolutionary survival loop where your body is simultaneously mobilizing for a tiger and conserving fuel because it's starving.
And we've seen that true, lasting healing requires two architectures. It requires the inner cleanup of salutogenesis, letting the night crew scrub the restaurant, and the outer safety of salutogenesis.
You need the factory to repair itself, but you also need the environment outside the factory to be physically and emotionally safe enough to let the guards down.
Your daily energy level is not just a random roll of the dice. It is a profound, continuous, eloquent dialogue between your microscopic cells and the macroscopic world you live in.
So to you listening to this right now, if you are struggling, please remember that your exhaustion is not a character flaw. It is a biological accounting.
Beautifully said.
It is a ledger showing your life's demands completely outstripping your restorative margins. It is your body doing exactly what it was brilliantly designed to do to keep you alive in an overwhelming world.
It is an invitation to finally listen to the organism, rather than constantly trying to force it to comply.
So I want to leave you with a completely new lens to view your life through. The next time you feel that heavy, bone-deep fatigue settling over you, instead of immediately reaching for another cup of coffee, instead of beating yourself up and asking, how can I force myself to push through this? I want you to stop.
Just pause.
Take a slow breath and ask your body, what are you trying to protect me from right now? And what conditions do I need to create in my life to make it safe for you to heal?